An expansion of the Human Rights Ordinance passes three city council committees. Speaking of the city council, they're also calling for a more diverse workforce in Jacksonville. And former Congresswoman Corrine Brown's chief of staff pleads guilty to two federal counts. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Never miss a show. Just download the WJCT app and listen anytime. And just ahead, all of the news of the week with our Friday roundtable. Do you have that Friday feeling? Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, we'll hear about a new book about the life of local civil rights icon Stetson Kennedy and a conversation with Daytona Beach YouTube sensation Joanne the Scammer. All of that and more ahead. But first, it's Friday, time for our weekly media roundtable, the most popular show of the week, as we welcome all stars David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
Claire Goforth, editor of Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
And our own WJCT reporter, Ryan Bank.
Good Friday morning.
Thanks for being here, guys. Lots to discuss. Everything from Corrine Brown's chief of staff, looking like he's going to take a plea deal, to interesting legislation about our workforce in Jacksonville. But our top story, three Jacksonville City Council committees this week voted in favor of expanding the city's human rights ordinance to cover the LGBT community from discrimination in the areas of jobs, housing, and public accommodations. 10 council members have to support the bill in committee, and if that holds, that would be enough votes to approve the bill and send it to Mayor Lenny Curry's desk to be signed into law. The big question is, will he do that? Now, on Wednesday, WJCT aired a community thread live television town hall to discuss the issue. We're going to listen to two shortcuts from that conversation before we go to our roundtable. Here's Dan Merkin of the Jacksonville Coalition for Equality saying this expansion is needed to protect his community.
What we know is that when LGBT people are protected, they're able to thrive in the workplace. They're able to have full, authentic lives in their communities. And that's really what we want to do in Jacksonville, is create an environment where it's about inclusion, that we honor diversity, and that all LGBT people can feel that they are welcome here and that they are going to be part of this community and supported.
Some business leaders disagreed. We spoke with one, Harry Lewis Jr. of Lewis Petroleum. He says this expansion would be an unnecessary burden.
In my view, this adds additional regulation that's not required. These are areas that are protected already, and through the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and the Fair Housing Act, and the lack of scenarios where it's come up as an issue, I'm just not a fan of more regulation.
Okay, and here's our question to callers. Where do you stand on expanding the human rights ordinance in Jacksonville? It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Weigh in on our Facebook page as well. And so, David Bauerlein, let's begin with you. And Tim Gibbons as well, you both cover business. The LGBT community is saying we need this to be fully accepted members of this community. We don't want to worry anymore about being fired from our jobs or being denied housing. Some business leaders say, as we heard from that gentleman, this is already covered. It's not necessary regulation. David.
I don't think it's already covered. I think that is something where this would fill a void right now in the law. And so I know there's a lot of interpretations of the federal law, but this would definitely make it clear that what the lines are.
And Tim Gibbons, let's talk about what is covered and what is not. Does the EEOC and does the Fair Housing Act adequately cover all protected classes of people in this country from these types of harms?
The adequate part is probably the opinion area where, you know, people who are opposed to this would say, sure, it's adequate now. Gender expression and sexual orientation are not covered the same way that race, religion, national origin, veteran status sort of thing is. So this does add a layer of protection that's not there now.
And we talked about this on the town hall the other night too, Claire. Jacksonville is the largest American city that has not yet updated its HRO or human rights ordinance to include this community of people.
Yes, that's correct. And if Jacksonville yet again rejects expanding the HRO to protect people on the basis of sexual orientation, gender identity, and expression, we become a city that has resoundingly rejected extending those protections to these individuals. And I think although some people are saying, well, Houston rolled theirs back and they're doing fine, they're still attracting these big-name sporting events because a lot of people have been concerned about what happened in North Carolina after HB2, it'll be a different situation in Jacksonville because not only will we have not done had one, I mean, we have rejected it. This will be, what, the third time, really? The second time it's gone up for a vote and failed.
And Ryan Bank, that's why you see the Jacksonville Chamber and other CEOs really pressing the city council hard on this. At last word, it looked as though there were the minimum 10 votes needed for passage. I think the big question, though, is will there be 13 votes? At that point, the measure could override a potential veto by Mayor Lenny Curry.
Right. And, you know, depending upon who you talk to, they, you know, some of the proponents, some of those bill sponsors actually think that they do have the votes, that they do have 13 votes to be able to pass this and make it safe from a potential veto from the mayor. You know, I was at the town hall, too, as you know, screening questions and kind of interacting with the audience. And, you know, I think the most effective argument the most effective argument against not passing the HRO seems to be that they're kind of asking, show me the money. You say these businesses aren't going to be here. You say that they don't want to expand here. Give me examples. Like I said, and I've said on the show before, you know, Amazon is still coming here. Wells Fargo is here. Deutsche Bank is here. All of these companies that have, you know, internal company policy that protects LGBT people, they're still doing business in Jacksonville. And I think that's a hard argument to kind of conquer if you're on the pro side.
But I have heard numerous instances of, then there was a developer out of South Florida who backed out of expanding into Jacksonville specifically because we did not pass the HRO expansion. And when we were in committee the other day at City Council, one of the council persons was talking about how when he has talked to businesses who are thinking about coming here, they sign these confidentiality agreements, so they can't really disclose why they do or do not come. But he did indicate very strongly that there have been numerous instances where their businesses have decided not to come to Jacksonville, and this was one of the factors that made them decide that
way. There's three main examples that are used that, you know, people can point to as somebody not coming here. There's a bank that said it would, or was said to be looking at Jacksonville, that went to Miami instead. There's the South Florida developer that Claire mentioned who bought some buildings in Five Points, said he was coming here. Actually, his quote was, Jacksonville is open to new ideas, and then he pulled back saying, until they pass the HRO, he won't do it. And there is the chairman of the Haskell company talked about a particular company who the guy said to him specifically, he's not coming because of the HRO. He didn't give the name, but he said it was a particular company.
Yeah, so we have these anecdotal reports, and David Bauerlein, as we talk about all of these issues, what about the politics of this for Mayor Curry? Let's say it passes the 10-vote threshold, but it doesn't get to 13. That puts Curry in, he will be squeezed then on both sides of this issue, and we'll have to weigh the pros and cons of letting it go into law or facing the blowback from a decision to veto it.
Right. It'll be a tough decision for him, or maybe not a tough decision, but certainly a decision for him to make. I mean, up to this point, his position has been that the expansion of the human rights ordinance is not needed. And so if it comes in with 13 or more votes, then obviously he can veto it and it still becomes law. If it comes in with more than 10, less than 13, or 10, 11, or 12 votes, then obviously he's the decisive voice in this in terms of what he decides to do.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's no big secret that Lenny Curry is a politician who probably, after he is completed his term of mayor, whether it's one or two terms, is going to look onto a bigger office. And this will be something that haunts him if he vetoes it, and it could also haunt him if he signs it. So that would be a very interesting decision.
It is the big question of where actually are we as a body politic? Of, is this the sort of thing that, honestly, a couple of years ago, I think people would have said vetoing this would be a, you know, we have moved on, we're in a new world, you can't veto this, you'll be on the wrong side of history. You look at what's happened both nationally and statewide in politics, and people can make a different calculation now.
Ryan.
Well, I was going to just agree with Tim on that. I mean, there's a new kind of cover that the mayor has to maybe be more vocal and pursue even more outwardly conservative policies, socially conservative policies, because of the last presidential election. Although at the same time, you did have President Trump, keeping in place the federal contractors' protections for LGBT people, you know, after a little bit of backlash, and some say that perhaps his daughter and his son-in-law were involved in you know, ensuring that he keeps those protections, but I have no idea what's going to happen.
I find it fascinating, as you know, somebody who covers business for a living, that a lot of these social issues, if you go back, would not have been in the realm of things that we would have written about, because it's not a business issue, except now it is.
Except, so, of course.
So now you have, you know, the CSX of the world, and you have a whole range of small and medium-sized businesses who have come out in favor of this. Obviously, there are also those who haven't. But you look at the mayor making the political calculation, Shad Khan coming out and telling the New York Times that he's in favor of this expansion. That's the type of thing that you gotta wonder how much weight does that end up playing in a political calculation when someone of that, you know, business stature comes out.
As you said, small businesses can go one of two ways on this, but overwhelmingly, corporate leaders are in this community. Most big companies in this community are speaking with one voice. This has long been accepted in corporate America,
and speaking out, not just kind of quietly, but actually taking a stand.
Well, I mean, you know, I hate to continue to be the cynical one on the panel here about this issue. I kind of feel like I think we all feel like Bill Murray in Groundhog Day.
Oh, it's just you have like no idea how often I feel like that.
You know, we're going over the same arguments here, but I have to kind of push back on that. What are they putting on the table? What are these businesses putting on the table? Sure, Shad Khan can make a statement to the New York Times about how he's in favor of this. Is he going to get ready to pull his team out of Jacksonville if it doesn't pass?
So you actually want... So Deutsche Bank did not expand in North Carolina, at least arguably because of the HB2. You basically want them to say, you know, they're expanding in Jacksonville. You want them to say they're not going to do it?
I'm saying talk is cheap. And HB2 is also a different thing that I also want to make sure that everyone understands, that we can't conflate HB2 with the failure to pass an HRO. HB2 is sort of the anti-HRO.
And we will talk about that. Lots of tweets coming in to the show. Josh tweets the show, the HRO is not an expansion to privilege special interests. It's simply an extension of fairness to all citizens. Jimmy tweets the show, EEOC and HUD are federal executive agencies. There is a new chief executive in Washington. It is unclear what that portends for protections. Lots of calls, too. Larry in St. Augustine. Hi, Larry. Good morning.
Yeah. Just a couple questions, actually. One is, all I hear you talk, basically, this is what everyone has said, is that this isn't, I haven't heard anyone talk about, well, actually, there is this prejudice or discrimination or whatever, but it appears to be green mail. So I guess it's important that Jacksonville just fall in line with all these other cities. And I'm not opposed to it. I mean, I don't have anything one way or the other. I just wanted to tell you that I'm listening to you, and that's everything you're saying is this is the result of green mail, even though there's not even any evidence, as one of you pointed out, of it. But the other,
I don't think that's true. I think, in fact, it's in the historic record that the Human Rights Commission, the City Council, have taken public testimonies from residents of this city who have recounted their life experience and how discrimination has impacted them.
But until you just mentioned it, it's not been mentioned.
Okay. I appreciate you pointing that out. And we can talk more about that.
But I just have a question for you. Earlier this week, you had a show where Jacksonville was one of the 50 best cities or whatever in the country to live. Was LGBT addressed in that article? Was that?
No, I don't believe it was. I don't believe it was, Larry. Yeah.
So whatever that group is, whoever selected it, this particular issue we're talking about wasn't a factor? I mean, is that fair to say, since it wasn't part of that. And again, I'm not taking a position one way or the other on this. I mean, I'm just trying to, you know, I listen and I'm just, you know what I mean, responding to what you're talking about and what you talked about recently.
Okay,
so if
sure.
LGBT wasn't an issue in deciding whether Jacksonville was one of the 50 best places to live, you know, isn't that something that you know, should factor in there? Maybe it's not as big of a deal.
Okay, yeah. No, thanks for the call. All right. And by the way, that ranking came from U.S. News and World Report.
I find interesting the, I don't know, that chain of thought, honestly, whatever side of the issue you're on. There's a zillion of those studies that come out. One of the, actually for a record correcting sort of thing, one of the bits of information that anti-HRO people have kept on citing is from the Jacksonville Business Journal, where we did a study in 2012 that showed that the small and medium business economy was the fastest growing city. Jacksonville had the small and medium business category was growing faster than any other city in Jacksonville in the year after the HRO was defeated. Our study did not connect those two at all, but proponents of defeating the bill often have, because they can point to one data point and another data point and put them together. So
it's the same thing with Jacksonville being, you know, the youngest, having the youngest right. median age, and you know, millennials moving here. But you know, a lot of these lists that come out from U.S. and World Report or any of these other places, I mean, you're like, to Tim's point, I mean, you're looking at specific data points about business.
The other point he made was you're talking about what he called green mailing, and you're not talking about the moral issue, which is that supporters of this measure say it's simply the right thing to do so that people who faced unlawful, in other cities, it's unlawful discrimination, have some sort of legal recourse.
The conversation used to be some people thought this was morally good and some people thought this was morally bad. And those two sides still agree with that. But that argument doesn't change anybody's mind. So now it's the people who are opposed to it think it's going to affect bathrooms, and the people who are in favor of it thinks it will affect business. And that's the conversation.
Yeah, and here's an email from Ed about that. Wouldn't the HRO pass if they just excluded locker rooms so parents wouldn't have to explain to their 8-year-olds why that lady or man has different plumbing?
I believe that Duval County Public Schools has long had a policy that was inclusive and allowed children to use the facilities that correspond with their gender identity with no issues. So I don't know that argument really does fly.
And if I could just go back to the caller's comment, I think he said he's from St. Augustine. Well, St. Augustine does include LGBT people in its anti-discrimination law. And St. Augustine, it's a big tourist city. So part of what we've heard here in Jacksonville is the Convention and Visitor Bureau saying, this is one of the questions people ask. When they are looking at what city they're going to put their convention in, they go through a checklist. It's not, well, if you don't have it, you're out of consideration. It's part of the mix. And that is a factor that all these business leaders are talking about.
Let's go to, real quick, let's go to Rose in Riverside. She's been holding. Hi, Rose. Good morning.
Good
go
morning.
Ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It was interesting listening to the comments that were being made. But having lived through discrimination and also in the city of Jacksonville, I'd like to say that I was very impressed to have seen what I thought were improvements over the years. But if we are still laboring under the false impressions that because people are different than we are, that we should not accept them. And I personally do not believe that God excludes anyone from his service or his protection. And even if our mayor is not in favor of extending or changing the statutes that impact on LGBTs, that any statute we have that excludes anyone should be changed.
All right. Thanks, Rose. Josh in Arlington. Josh, what say you? Good morning.
Oh, hey, Melissa, and hi, guest. Earlier this week on the show, or at some point on NPR with local coverage, they were talking about how Bill Guilford and a few other guys or people on the council want to send it to referendum. And somebody responded with, if you want to put these on the referendum, let's just put all the rights under the HRO on referendum. I mean, if we're going to decide you know, the minorities' rights versus by vote, we should put them all out there, the religious ones too. And I thought that that was a great idea.
Thanks, Josh.
And I'd like to hear y'all's thoughts on that.
All right. Thanks, Josh.
Well, the concept of having the majority vote on the rights of the minority is referred to as tyranny of the majority because it is just statistically going to show that they will not vote to extend rights to the minority. And beyond which, a lot of the classes that are protected under our HRO are already protected under federal law. So even though it does extend a local cause of action to people for these types of discrimination, with or without it, you'd still be prohibited from discriminating against people on the basis of race, religion, gender, and disability.
But not sexual orientation or gender identity. There's no federal statute for that group of people.
And I think that's a very important point. There is no federal statute. There is no state statute that protects LGBT people. So the reason why LGBT activists are concentrating so heavily on these local ordinances across the country is because the state, their states and the federal government don't have laws protecting people. So we're, you know, gay people are not included.
All right. And if you're just tuning in, we've been talking about the human rights ordinance here on the show, but we're going to move on and make mention of a few other important headlines from the week. It's 549-2937 to join us. Also making headlines this week, the chief of staff to former Congresswoman Karine Brown, Ronnie Simmons, pleaded guilty this week to two federal counts, and he may testify against his former boss in her trial. Brown maintains her innocence, but a judge this week refused to delay her trial. It's coming up in April on federal corruption and conspiracy charges. Both Simmons and Brown are accused of using an unregistered charity to raise nearly $1 million that the feds say they used as a personal slush fund. So as Ronnie Simmons looks to probably take a plea deal, we'll have to see how it shakes out for Karine Brown.
Not in a good way. I mean, no. This was not the news that she wanted to hear this week.
No. Right. And go ahead, Claire.
This is her third attorney. Is that correct?
And gotta catch them all.
The attorney that she has now doesn't seem to have any history of high-level litigation of this nature. And the fact that the judge denied that motion to delay trial indicates that possibly the attorney has not been doing quite as much of the legwork that is necessary to prepare for trial. I mean, it sounds to me that he may be in over his head.
I think one thing, too, to call Ronnie Simmons her chief of staff is accurate, but really doesn't go far enough to cover the breadth of this long-term relationship. I mean, they've been together for years and years and years, and it's stunning that he is essentially going to, looks like...
He's going to throw her under the bus, yeah,
and
to save himself.
Be a witness for the government.
For the government.
Yeah, stunning.
You know, a lot of reporters around town, you know, have written about this since the beginning of this saga, saying that, you know, the reason why she went through all these lawyers is because each one of them most likely told her, this doesn't look good. You need to, you know, make a deal here. And she refuses to make a deal. And so she went through and she has a lawyer that will do what she wants to do. And I don't see this ending well for her at all.
But in the end, though, the feds, they come with these huge charges, decades in prison. Often it ends with a whimper, you know, with the person doing a deal, doing little to no prison time, maybe a nominal amount of time.
Right.
We could see
those,
that ending this way for both of these individuals.
Those headline numbers always are, you know, the maximum possible thing, and rarely, if ever, does anybody get the maximum possible thing. But you know, this is in some ways, a fairly straightforward sort of case. And with her chief of staff basically turning on her, it will be interesting to see how quickly this progresses through.
Yeah, and if the goal of a prison term is to rehabilitate the individual, I would say that it may not even be necessary at this point, because what is her ability to behave in this manner in the future, you know, given that she was found guilty? If she was.
All right. And also this week, two city council committees approved a bill sponsored by Councilman Garrett Dennis. He says will promote workforce diversity. Dennis said he drafted the measure after five JEA employees filed federal discrimination charges against the community-owned utility. That's a story broken by our own Ryan Bank, and that is one that you continue to follow.
Right. So it's been interesting to watch because it's tracked very closely with the HRO. So every single committee that the HRO had to go through, the same two committees this bill had to go through. Obviously, most of the attention has been on the HRO. It's been a big argument, and it's the third time they've tried to pass it. But you know, basically what this bill does is it reinstitutes a position that used to exist within the Human Rights Commission as an assistant director, now being called manager of diversity or equal opportunity. And it also requires that these independent agencies take these federal reports about their demographics that they already have to turn in for their federal funds and present them to city council and come up with strategies to diversify their workforce. And people that have heard the continuing JEA story would know that only about 16 to 17% of the JEA workforce is actually African American, even though the city's African American population is above 30%. And of course, that 17% dwindles as you get higher up in on the ladder of the of JEA.
And I did not realize this, but Dennis is calling for the position of diversity manager for the city of Jacksonville. For years, I guess that's been a job that has been left vacant.
Yeah, it's actually codified, I believe, in the statute that they mm-hmm. should have it, and it just hasn't been funded. So
right.
It's something that, you know, would be an actual step to, again, not to have quotas, not to actually require any particular actions, but have somebody whose job it is to pay attention to it. And, you know, mm-hmm. the old adage that you get what you measure, if nobody is actually keeping an eye on these figures, nothing, why would anything change?
Yeah, I mean, the actual requirement of the legislation is pretty, you know, it's not really, doesn't get raise any red flags. However, the intent, which is to further the city's commitment to a diverse workforce that was reasonably representative of the community, could give rise to at least an argument that it does create a quota system, which would possibly, if someone challenged it, allow it to survive a motion to dismiss and mm-hmm. lead to a little prolonged litigation potentially. It's not very clear, and I think Ryan may be able to answer a little bit more on that.
Well, so in Florida, you know, I think it was the year 2000. There was a Supreme Court case and a law. Basically, Florida has banned any affirmative action programs in public employers and public universities. However, organizations that receive federal funding have to abide by federal regulations, and the federal government allows affirmative action. So it's really not clear how this ordinance will shake out. And what's really, really interesting about it is that one human rights commissioner that I've spoken to in particular, his whole complaint was it doesn't go far enough. There aren't any penalties. Sure, there's a reporting requirement, but there isn't any specifics about how you change poor diversity at some of these independent agencies. And now it puts – there's so much pushback on council, specifically from Councilman Matt Schellenberg, whose argument was that this seems like a quota bill. It puts Dennis in the awkward position of kind of – fighting on the left and right.
Well, it's been a busy news week, but of course, we also have to take a quick look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida. And only in Florida do people steal a golf cart by mistake. A villager's son helped solve the mystery of his father's missing golf cart, which was taken by some snowbirds in error. Jay Skiff over at the Villages had his golf cart stolen at the Spanish Springs Town Square. His iPhone was also in the cart, and his son suggested he use the Find My iPhone app to locate the phone. He did and learned that a couple from Pennsylvania mistakenly took the cart during a grocery run. If you've ever been to the Villages, you know that everybody there drives around on a golf cart. Speaking of stealing different modes of transport, only in Florida does a student take a bus for a joyride. Police in Lynn Haven say 17-year-old Zachary Martin stole his school bus Saturday night and decided to take it out for a trip up County Road 389. As an officer began following the bus, it started swerving back and forth. It was going way below the speed limit and almost hit another vehicle head-on. Luckily, they stopped it before anybody got hurt.
Didn't somebody hijack the Skyway once? You couldn't tell. But I mean,
that's right. And finally, only in Florida is everybody constantly getting knocked upside the head. In a new report surprising absolutely no one here at the Only in Florida headquarters, the data firm Amino finds that Florida leads the nation in head injuries. Now, the study looked at which types of injuries were most common in all 50 states. For example, in Hawaii, near drowning is very common. But Florida is the only state where head injury is listed as the most routine problem, sending people for medical treatment.
News coming out of Florida has never made so much sense.
That's right. Thank you, David Barreline, Claire Goforth, Timothy Givens, and Ryan Bank. Thanks, everybody.
Have a good weekend.
You too. Thank you, Melissa. We'll be right back.
Hendrix Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Had enough of partisan politics, he said, she said, and showbiz? I'm Ira Flatto. On Science Friday, we deal with facts that really impact your life, like how climate change will affect your neighborhood, what's new in healthcare, why do we know so little about our universe? So join in and become part of an intelligent conversation. Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele, inviting you to join us this weekend for a live broadcast of our Prairie Home Companion from the famed Fitzgerald Theater in downtown St. Paul. Our guests include Lucius, Brad Meldow, and comedian Tom Papa, plus our acting company, Serena Brooks, Sue Scott, Tim Russell, and our sound effects man, Fred Newman, my song of the week, our first call radio players, and more.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Relax Radio, playing the soundtrack of your life nightly at midnight, only on 89.9 FM WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, a new book is out with a comprehensive look at the life of the late civil rights legend and folklorist Stetson Kennedy. Peggy Bulger is the author of Stetson Kennedy, Applied Folklore and Cultural Advocacy. And she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
And you are the state's first folklorist, so this comes naturally for you. You knew Stetson Kennedy for decades, and what a treasure, a new book about his incredible life.
Yes, actually, I came to Florida in 1976 and met Stetson soon after. He became a mentor and a friend. But his life was absolutely amazing, and as most people say, he's probably the most amazing person you've never heard of.
Exactly. He, of course, grew up and lived his whole life here in Northeast Florida. He was famous for infiltrating the Ku Klux Klan and writing about it as far back as the 1940s. Mm-hmm. He wrote many books, but he was also a folklorist, and so you look at his life through that prism, too.
Yes, actually, what the book is about is how folklore is so powerful. And most people, we don't even realize how much of our lives are caught up in our own folklore and what we believe, and our beliefs become how we live our lives. So Stetson realized that early on. He was a self-taught folklorist from an early age, and how he actually infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan and got their charter revoked in Georgia was by using their folklore against them.
How did he do it?
Well, what he would do, he was infiltrating the Klan, of course, and he knew the power of naming and the power of secrecy in terms of secret societies, like any society, like a fraternity, a sorority, whatever. We all have our secrets. Even the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts have folklore. So he infiltrated the Klan and and was working with Drew Pearson, who was a reporter and a columnist. He was also working with...
with the New York Times or Washington Post?
He was doing... he did a thing called the Washington Post. It was the Washington merry-go-round.
That's right.
And he was an amazing guy who, you know, was working with Stetson. Stetson had infiltrated the Klan in Stone Mountain, Georgia, and he would get the secret passwords, the secret handshakes, the secret, you know, there were certain words that you said if you saw somebody on the street and you wanted to figure out if they were a Klan member. Those secrets were told.
Yeah, it published all over the country.
Right.
Right.
And then also he was a consultant to the Superman radio show, which was being produced, of course, nationally back before television. This is in the 40s. So everyone was listening to Superman, and they had a whole series of shows called Superman Battles the Fiery Cross and Superman and the Fiery Cross. And it was about Superman battling the forces of hate and evil. And it's a lesson that needs to be learned in every generation.
Now, you've done extensive interviews and research, all of his writings, to put together this book, with help from the Florida Historical Society. So this is a way for people that didn't know about the impact of this man and how he was based right here in our area while he was alive. This is a way for people to get a window into his life now.
Absolutely. And, you know, some of the things when I interviewed him about being part of the, he was the head of the Federal Writers Project here, the folklore unit. He was Zora Neale Hurston's boss. People don't know that. And also he was a great friend of Woody Guthrie, who lived on his land for about 18 months.
So. Down in St. John's County.
St. John's County, right on Old St. Augustine Road, on 50 acres. It's now a county park. St. John's County owns the property, and it's called Beloothahatchee, which means a place of peace and harmony.
And when he passed away, of course, there was a wonderful memorial service for him at Beloothahatchee. Gosh, it's been a couple of years now.
He passed away in 2011 at the age of 94. And so, yes, they had a wonderful service for him. But Beloothahatchee now is open on Sundays. You can Google it and get their schedule of events, because they do have folk singing and different educational programs.
Definitely worth checking out. Uh-huh. And pick up Peggy's new book. It's Stetson Kennedy, Applied Folklore and Cultural Advocacy. Peggy Bulger, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Back in a moment.
I'm Joshua Johnson. On the next 1A, it's the Friday News Roundup. A lot's been said this week, and some have been asked to keep quiet.
I am surprised that the words of Coretta Scott King are not suitable for debate in the United States Senate.
The words of the week, new cabinet members, the travel ban, and the president's bathrobe? Next time on 1A's Friday News Roundup. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Vince Kong, host of Redux, WJCT's weekly news magazine and the news podcast of the First Coast. Tune in to catch up on the latest local stories, plus music from our after-hours programming, anytime, anywhere. Subscribe to WJCT Redux now on your favorite podcast app.
Finally. Welcome to my Caucasian home. Come inside.
These are Malaysian bamboo florists. Yes. This is my house.
Well, he's the Daytona Beach YouTube sensation known as Joanne the Scammer. 25-year-old Brandon Miller is African-American and gay, and he used to make a living acting in porn films. But now Miller has gained a cult following for creating Joanne. She is a person who sees herself as a rich white woman who breaks into people's homes, steals their stuff, and lives for drama. I spoke with Miller about why Joanne, the character, gets right at our fault lines of race, class, and gender in America and makes us laugh, too. Take a listen. It is really incredible to see how you have blown up on YouTube and social media from where you live down in Daytona Beach with this character you've created, Joanne the Scammer.
Yep.
She's so funny. Well, yeah, so what is Joanne's theme?
Well, she thinks she's Caucasian, and she, you know, she wears a fur coat.
This is, wow, one of the more better things in my house. The refrigerator. We have leaves, and we love leaves here. Leaves and kombucha ginger ale. It's real good. It's good for vibrant skin, toenails. We have colored eggs. Now, I know I'm white, but white people have colored eggs, as I like to call them, minority eggs. Real good. I like to crack them open. Real messy.
You know what I mean? It was no scene while Joanne has, like, the fur coat, the dress, the way she talks, her lips, her fingers. I mean, down to it. Everything.
You know? She's very identified with being Caucasian. And why did you decide to make Joanne Caucasian and build her whole identity around that?
Well, she's Mexican American. She just likes to call herself Caucasian. I did a video as Joanne the Scammer, and I was trying to tell my, you know, well, her boyfriend that she has upgraded her lifestyle and she's living like a Caucasian now. She's living great. She's doing good.
Joanne and just the reaction to Joanne online has just been incredible. Now you've crashed the VMAs. That caused a big scene. You put up a fake website, drakeandrihanna.com. People thought it was about Drake and Rihanna, but it was really about you once they clicked on it.
Yep.
Now you are selling welcome mats that say, "Get out of my Caucasian house." And in this video, we see you as Joanne in this sweatshop, and it's full of Latino workers at sewing machines making these welcome mats that say, "Get out of my Caucasian house." 50% of the profits from these welcome mats are going to the ACLU. And so is that your way of protesting or resisting President Trump?
I'd say yeah. Because the commercial, if you looked at it, you know, Joanne is supposed to be quote-unquote Caucasian, and I am in a room full of Mexicans. And that was my way to, and then when you purchase it, the money goes to a great sound. I think people knew what I was doing. You know what I mean? And I kind of received the backlash because, you know, there are so many people that do support Trump, and I don't think they like that too much. But yeah.
And you live in Daytona Beach. You've been there for a while. Do you plan on staying in Daytona Beach? What if California calls and says, you know, we have projects for you?
Yeah, they have, and I'm like actually in the talks of like a TV show, and like I probably will be stationed out there for a little bit while I'm recording, you know, shooting the show. But I just,
what's the show?
I don't know yet. I'm doing a Joanne the Scammer show. We're talking about basically putting together a pilot, and I start shooting that I think sometime in April.
Well, it's a pleasure to speak with you. You're so funny and right down the road from us. Brandon Miller, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, finally this hour, they work to bridge the gap between the support that students need and what schools are designed to provide. City Year, AmeriCorps members work in under-resourced schools across 28 cities to identify kids who are at risk of not graduating on time with their peers. Here in Jacksonville, a deadline's coming up if you want to join City Year. Here with more, we welcome Lindsay Rose, AmeriCorps member serving at Eugene J. Butler Middle School, and Maya Francis, Regional Recruitment Manager for City Year. Good morning.
Good morning.
Maya, let's start with you. February 15th is the deadline if people want to be part of City Year for the next school year. What type of applicants are you looking for?
Well, we are looking for leaders between the ages of 18 to 25 who are committed and very passionate about serving in the school systems that we serve in.
Okay. Lindsay, you're doing that right now. You're an AmeriCorps member. You are serving at Eugene Butler Middle School. Tell me about what that involves.
So we work every day full time in our schools, working with whole class support, but then also individualized interventions in the areas of ELA, math, and then also working with attendance and behavior.
And what's it like to work with kids?
Oh, they're the best. I mean, I'm in a middle school, and I've learned so much from them also while I'm teaching them.
And you're there to support the teachers that are already there.
Of course, yes.
And provide just extra help, extra support.
Absolutely. So if we're working in the whole class space, we're just working along with the teachers, you know, working in small groups with the students, or even just helping with management of the classroom.
And let's be clear, Maya, this is not Teach for America. This is something else altogether. This is another program where young people can serve in our nation's public schools.
Yes, it's a 10-month commitment, and we are located in 28 different cities nationwide. So whenever the students would like to join, they can just come on board with the application process.
Let's explain what this means for the students or the young people. They don't make a lot of money. They get a small stipend, and they share housing with other AmeriCorps members. So it's a sacrifice. It's a way to get public service, but it's certainly not the same as going into banking or something like that.
Yes, but working in our schools with our students really does. It is worth it because we do get to, you know, do that every day, and it's amazing.
And after you complete your City year, you can apply for scholarships and other opportunities.
Yes, so there's a number of other benefits. So the students do receive what's called the Siegel Award, which is $5,815 to go towards if they have any loans acquired in the school or university, as well if they're looking to go to a grad program, they can take that money along with them.
And how many applicants do you need to fill the schools here in Jacksonville for next year?
We have around 130 slots open in Jacksonville. Right now we have 17 confirmed members, so we're just keeping it moving as far as those who are interested in Jacksonville.
Now, Lindsay, how old are you?
I'm 25.
And once you finish with City Year, what do you plan to do?
I'm actually planning on getting my master's in social work.
Very nice. And so you'll finish in May at Butler and then go on to graduate school?
Yes.
All right. Well, again, if you're just tuning in, an application deadline is coming up for a relatively new program in Jacksonville, City Year. They are working in our public schools. This is through AmeriCorps, and this is a way for you as a young college graduate to be a tutor, mentor, a coach, a big brother or sister, and many other roles. Did you start that way, Maya?
No, actually, I joined City Year not too long ago in June, and really it was just because I'm from Jacksonville and just that passion to really impact the schools that I'm from and the communities.
Where did you go to school?
I went to Stanton, and for middle school, Darnell Cookman, and elementary school, Martin Luther King.
A lifelong product of Duval.
Yes, Duval County Public Schools.
Well, again, go to cityyear.org if you or a young person you know should apply for this opportunity. The deadline is next Wednesday, February 15th, cityyear.org. And thank you so much for being here, Maya Francis, recruitment manager, and Lindsay Rose. She's a City Year AmeriCorps member working in Eugene Butler Middle School this year. Ladies, thanks for all you're doing for the community, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
That is our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board, the show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. If you have questions or comments, we want your feedback. Send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen anytime. Up next on 1A, the Friday News Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.